Welcome to BIO, a podcast produced by the Biographers International Organization. BIO is devoted to promoting the work of biographers and advocating for biography as a genre with the support of biographers and biography lovers worldwide. I'm BIO member Sonia Williams in Washington, D.C. On each episode, we talk with biographers about their work. This time, first-time biographer Jared Stearns talks about his book, Pure, The Sexual Revolutions of Marilyn Chambers. Published by Head Press in May 2024, this book explores the untold story of Chambers, the world's most famous X-rated star. Jared Stearns currently serves as the editor of BIO's newsletter, and he was interviewed by fellow biographer and BIO member Simon Reed.
Jared, before we begin, I just want to say how much I enjoyed the book. It's fantastic. It's so well done. It's beautifully written. I think one of the things you do really well is that because of the subject matter, one might have the preconceived notion that it's very voyeuristic in nature, but it's not. It's a very human story. This is really sort of a warning against the pitfalls of pursuing fame. And I came away sort of feeling sad for Marilyn, but also having a lot of respect about her. But how did you stumble across Marilyn Chambers? And how old were you when you first saw her work?
Well, first of all, thank you for those kind words about the book. I appreciate that very much. I was about 13 and I went snooping in my grandfather's dresser drawer for adult material and found it in the form of a VHS called Marilyn Chambers Private Fantasies Number 2, which was part of the 6-volume direct-to-video series she did in the 80s. And this would be in the early 90s or so. And I watched it and I was instantly taken with her. I didn't know the phrase star quality, but that's what she had. And it was palpable even through a videotape. And I wasn't sexually attracted to her as a gay man, but she had that thing, sort of that it factor. And I would hear her name referenced on television shows in the 90s, usually as a punchline. And it occurred to me that she must be really famous for people to know who she was and get the joke if she was a punchline. Also, how unusual that was for someone I had seen in an X-rated film to be so well-known, because even today, there are still only a handful of people primarily known for X-rated films who are household names, and she was one of them. Then in 2011, I went to see here in San Francisco a retrospective of X-rated films made in the city, because this was called, in the 70s, the smut capital of America. The New York Times gave us that dubious honor. They closed the retrospective with a film called Resurrection of Eve, which was starring Marilyn Chambers and made by the Mitchell brothers here. It's a film they did after Behind the Green Door, which was their big success. I went purely out of my fondness for her, and something happened in the theater. I don't know what, but it was akin to watching her on video for the first time. It was just that magnetism, that star quality that I found captivating. And I didn't immediately say, I have to write a book. I just thought, I have to find out all I can about this person. And by this point, she had passed away in 2009. So she had been gone a couple years. So I just set about researching, and I spent the next 8 years researching, mostly as a fan and someone who wanted to just really get to know who she was. Then in around 2019, I said, I have to tell her story, because by then she had been largely forgotten. So I wanted to make sure that people remembered her.
And was that the impetus to tell her story, the fact that she, you know, she had been forgotten, or was it the result of your research and sort of finding out that there's kind of a dynamic existence behind just what you see on the screen when, you know, in her movies?
Yeah, both of those. I don't argue in the book for or against pornography. I'll leave that to sociologists and philosophers. But regardless of one's opinion about pornography, it is kind of a general fascination of how do people become involved in X-rated films, particularly women. And I'm talking about adult women who consensually agree to enter the X-rated industry. But beyond that, she was so much more famous than people realize and did far more non-X-rated stuff than X-rated stuff, which I found fascinating. And she was part of the sexual revolution. She was part of the women's movement. She was at the center of this huge moment in American pop culture history. And I thought, everyone talks about her contemporary, Linda Lovelace, who was in a film called Deep Throat, but she only did a couple movies and then became anti-porn. So I found her story to be rather tiresome, but Marilyn's story was very engaging. And there was way more to it than people realized. And then in around 2019, I became friendly with her daughter, McKenna, who lives here in the Bay Area. And I said, I'd really love to write a book about your mom. And she had always wanted someone to write a book or do a documentary or something to maintain her mom's legacy. And so we became great friends. And she said, yeah, she didn't interfere or anything. She just trusted me to tell the story as honestly and well as I could.
And you're a first time biographer. This is a pretty meaty subject for your, for your first time out. How did you go about, you wrote the proposal, you took it out to agents. Did you sort of, or did you approach agents first and go, you know, I've got this idea. I'm looking at, talk us through that process.
I actually went to bio first when I fully committed to the project myself, when I said, okay, I am going to write this book. And it was just something in me that I knew I had to do it. I had never written a book. My background's in journalism and marketing. So I had some basic skills, but I'd never writing a book, obviously, is very different. And I thought, I need some help. I did a Google search and found the Biographers International Organization and that they had a mentorship program. So I was paired with someone who immediately said, okay, you have a good subject. Like, this is definitely a pop culture figure. So there will be a publisher who's interested. And they walked me through the proposal process. And I did a proposal. They even edited it for me. And then I took the proposal and went about searching for agents, which was really, really difficult. Everyone said it was going to be hard. It was way more challenging than I thought it was going to be. And I got I got a number of people saying, well, I'm interested, but I'm going to have to pass.
Was there like puritanical reasoning behind that?
I think one has to read between the lines. I'm sure, you know, the agents are looking at it like, can I sell this? But also, do I want to take on this project? And there were a couple of responses that were just very terse in that I am not representing, not me, this book. So whether, you know, people bring their own prejudices to the table, I'm sure, which is true for publishers as well, because I did get an agent actually through a connection at Bio, and my agent loved it. And saw immediately the potential for it and that it could sell. But publishing is an old industry, and especially in the United States, old-fashioned and conservative to a large degree. And a lot of people turned it down, you know, and we both sort of agreed that most of those who turned it down, it's probably because she was a porn star, so much so that we actually took the word porn out of our proposal and referred to her only as an adult film star. And only after we did that did we start getting more interest. So that word has just a lot of, it comes with a lot of preconceived notions and conscious and unconscious prejudices. So, yeah.
Which is kind of funny when you have publishers then like sort of trying to get Stormy Daniels to publish.
Absolutely. And
her story.
Right. Stormy Daniels and even Linda Lovelace wrote a book. And just writing about controversial topics. And there are certainly publishers who specialize in publishing books about controversial topics, but we really wanted someone who would treat this with respect. And fortunately, we found it, but my publisher is based in the UK, which doesn't surprise me. I'm not surprised that we ended up with a UK publisher because, first of all, we found it the right home. They really wanted the book. They saw the potential. They had a great respect for Marilyn Chambers. And so, you know, it's a happy ending in that we found it the right place.
No pun intended.
No pun intended. There are going to be a lot of puns, I think, in this. But I'm not surprised that American publishers turned it down flatly, because as progressive as they might like to believe they are, and some of them might be, there's an undercurrent of conservatism that runs through there. And how am I going to sell a book about it and market a book about a porn star? It's been done before, so I don't see the hesitation, but it's their loss.
Absolutely. So you've got your agent, you've got the publishing deal, you are a first-time biographer, first-time author, you've got this dynamic subject.
Yeah.
Where do you start? How do you get the ball rolling on this thing?
Yeah, so I mean, I had spent 8 years researching, but mostly it was not with the notion that I would write a book. So a lot of it was just as a fan and as a collector. So a lot of the materials existed in my closet, buying things and getting them off eBay and stuff. And because, you know, the world of X-rated films is not Hollywood, so they don't keep or did not keep meticulous records about production notes, about budgets. You know, a lot of them were affiliated with organized crime. That's just who often supplied funds or financing for X-rated films across the board. So from what I understand, organized crime members don't like to keep a paper trail.
You don't say. That's
Yeah,
fascinating.
so there wasn't a lot, you know, and if there were contracts or anything like that, they've just been lost over time. We're talking about 50 years ago. But once I committed to the project, I had all this information, but it mostly existed in my head. So I had to get it on the page. And I just kind of, I had written some sample chapters, but I kind of used that as a starting point and then just would just kind of go chapter by chapter, maybe talk a little bit about her early life and all that stuff, and try to set up interviews with people like her brother and sister and people who really knew her for a long time, and friends and family and people she worked with. So that took about a year.
How did you go about tracking down people, you know, to interview?
Yeah, well, as far as her friends and her family, because her daughter was affiliated with this and authorized this and approved it and was supportive of it, that helped. But Marilyn's brother and sister were not really thrilled or very reluctant to talk to me,
really,
as were longtime friends of Marilyn's, because they're very protective of McKenna, her daughter, because McKenna lost her mom when she was 17 unexpectedly. So they're very protective of her, understandably. And McKenna is very protective of her mom and her mom's legacy. So there was a lot of hesitation in talking to this random guy. And even when Marilyn's daughter would say, like, it's okay, you can talk to him, there was still a lot of hesitation on the friends and family side. People in the adult entertainment industry love to talk, so it was very easy to track them down. Except there is a caveat. There are some people who have done X-rated films in the 70s and 80s who have since denounced the industry, and they don't talk about it. Even though she did way more non-X-rated stuff than X-rated stuff, like she fronted a country western band. She was in a cabaret. She was in a Broadway or off-Broadway musical. She was in... had her own TV show. Some of those people, because she was Marilyn Chambers, I did get a few people who said, I really liked working with her, but I don't want to talk to you because I don't want my family to know that I worked with her, even though it was in a non-X-rated setting.
Right.
I'm like, okay, well, you can, a quick Google search, you can find your name. So I didn't quite
understand. It's not secret. It's not secret information.
It's not that secret. But most of the, like, certainly the actors and actresses who worked with her in X-rated films, more than happy to talk. And most of them, unfortunately, many of them have passed. But the ones who had not were really cool, very open, and very willing to talk. But I did get a few people who formerly worked in the adult entertainment industry who had never spoken on the record before, who were very close with Marilyn. But she also did a film with David Cronenberg, and I talked to him. There were a few no's I got from high-profile Hollywood directors and actors. Yep. But whoever talked to me, friends, family, coworkers, they all really, really loved her. And that was palpable. Still love her very much and miss her.
Yeah, actually, I wanted to ask you that. When you were talking to people who knew her, did your perspective of her change at all? Did you go in with any preconceived notions and talking to people changed anything about the way you thought about her?
Not really, because I always admired her. I always liked her. I always had that sort of reverence for her. There were things she did, you know, in her life and her career that I didn't like or didn't care for. Her second husband, who was also her manager, Chuck Traynor, who was previously married to and managed Linda Lovelace, was just frankly a horrible human being. And she was with him for 10 years. And he was abusive. He was physically and emotionally violent. He was just a really bad guy, and also illiterate to boot. So why did she stay with him for so long? And no one could really give an answer to that. So there were things she did that frustrated me a lot, but it didn't make me lose any respect for her because I wasn't there. I didn't know her. And I'll never really know the truth behind that. And because she died unexpectedly and so young, she took so much of the history and the context with her. So I just had to do the best I could with, you know, trying to figure it out without being too much of an armchair psychologist and without too much supposition or contemplating what could have been.
Sort of along those same lines. I mean, you know, Marilyn is someone who can be viewed through the lens of controversies and sensationalism. You were talking about when you started the project, you were mapping it out on how you wanted to tell the story. How did you work to make sure she came across as sort of like a fully realized person, which she does? I mean, like I said, it's a very human story. Were you aware of the pitfalls that sort of lay in wait tackling a subject like this?
Yeah, I think because I knew this wasn't about porn, and the way my agent and I pitched it was this is a celebrity biography about a woman in show business who happened to do adult films, not a book about a porn star. And because I had so much respect for her anyway, I wanted to tell her story. I wanted it to be truthful and honest. So I wanted to show the ugly side. You know, she suffered from addiction. She was in, you know, violent relationships. I didn't want to gloss over that, but I also didn't want to make that the focal point. I wanted people to know she was a human being. She was, you know, a wife, a mother, a daughter, a woman. She was much more than just a porn star. And that label is just so
crass.
Yeah, crass and just so tiresome. And what I mean, it's just so it's just a label that doesn't really accurately describe who she was. It describes one aspect of her work. But pornography is in the eyes of the beholder. So one thing can be pornographic to some person and not to another. So then you get down into the weeds about, well, what is pornography and all that? But at that time, that's what they were deciding. What is obscene and what isn't? And First Amendment rights. And at the time in the 70s, when she really blew up and was in a film called Behind the Green Door, the authorities were raiding X-rated movie theaters because that was the only way you could see an adult film. There was no internet. There, you know, books and films were, you know, banned, and they were throwing movie theater owners in jail. They would arrest the patrons. So it's a timely story, and it's timeless in that, you know, we're sort of living through a period of a great reckoning in terms of what is acceptable, what is obscene, what is not, and what are our rights, particularly as American citizens, and what is protected as First Amendment speech and First Amendment freedoms. And she was at the center of that during the sexual revolution in the early 70s. So that was really one of the driving forces behind writing it, is I wanted people to know she was there, and she was directly at the epicenter of that.
Yeah, she was a warrior in many ways, isn't
yeah,
she? I mean,
she was
like fighting for a cause. And it's interesting because in the book, you talk about there's that period in the 70s where adult films, they hit the mainstream. You have people lining up around the block to see Behind the Green Door and Deep Throat. These weren't like guys in trench coats scurrying into, you know, theaters and back alleys. I mean, these were like major movie theaters playing these films, and they were like becoming major box office successes.
Yeah. For a very brief shining moment, porn became respectable in American culture and really international culture, but mostly in American culture. That started with Deep Throat in 1972. And it succeeded in part because the government went after it and tried to shut it down. So that just built up more press, and it became the thing to do. And celebrities started going to see it. And you would have celebrities being photographed by the paparazzi in line to see Deep Throat. So now that became mainstream America, and sort of middle America became really interested in, well, if Johnny Carson and Jack Nicholson and Warren Beatty and Jacqueline Onassis, a former first lady, are going to see this film, maybe I should go see this film. And they did. And Behind the Green Door came out 2 months after Deep Throat, but it really didn't blow up until 1973, when it was learned that the star of the film, Marilyn Chambers, also happened to be the model on the newly released box of Ivory Snow laundry detergent. She was the mom holding the baby, a photo she had taken when she was 17, 2 years before the movie, completely forgot about it, and the exact set, Procter & Gamble, which is still one of the major consumer manufacturer goods in the country, decided to enter the now generation as with a new box of Ivory Snow Laundry detergent, which was marketed specifically towards young mothers because it was soft enough to wash a baby's clothes. And of course, the famous tagline was 99 of 44, 100% pure.
Hence and the title of the book.
Hence the title of the book. And it seems so quaint and adorable now, almost too precious, that that would be a controversy. But 50 years ago, that was a major and international controversy, that the symbol of young American motherhood could also be the same woman on screen joyously cavorting in sexual positions unseen by the human eye in a film. And young couples were going to see it. Older people were going to see it. Like, you know, people
in the family, you know, come on.
Well, maybe not exactly family, but I will say that they started advertising X-rated films in newspapers. The New Yorker started to list movie listings. They were reviewed as regular films. So when you would open the newspaper, you'd see an ad for Go See Behind the Green Door with the Ivory Snow Girl right next to the latest ad for a Disney movie, only in the 70s, right? It was a thing, and it only lasted about a year and a half, but she became an international celebrity because of it. The Mitchell brothers, who made the film, took the film.
It made them very rich, the Mitchell brothers.
Very, very rich, yeah. And made her very rich as well, because she, when she auditioned for the film, negotiated a percentage of the gross profits of all the film.
And she did that without agent representation. I mean, she was very sharp. She handled her own negotiations.
She was a good businesswoman. And this was before the Ivory Snow thing. So she, I mean, she actually did it a way to try to get out of, because she was getting nervous about doing, saying yes to an X-rated film. But they gave her what she wanted, and she agreed to do it. And she was, you know, stubborn and proud. And she said, okay, I'm going to do this. And it worked for her. And she became internationally famous, and then decided, okay, I'm done with X-rated films. I want to do mainstream entertainment. And she did, but she found out pretty quickly that the X-rated stuff, that's all anyone would want to talk about in interviews. Yeah. And she came very close to having some really big names. She's supposed to work with Nicholas Ray and Rip Torn and Norman Mailer in a film. And that fell through because of tax laws.
What was the movie where she actually auditioned for the role of a porn star? And they're like, you don't look like a porn star. You can't. She's like, but I am.
Yeah. And that's how I opened the book, because she went to audition for a film called Hardcore, which was released.
Oh, George C. Scott. Yeah.
George C. Scott. Paul Schrader wrote and directed it in 79. And she went to audition, and she was auditioning for the role of a porn star. And during the audition, the casting director said, I'm sorry, we can't use you. We're looking for a porn star type. And she said, what are you talking about? I am a porn star. I'm the most famous porn star in the world. And they said, you're too wholesome looking. And she said, yeah, that's why I'm the most famous porn star in the world. You don't expect the wholesome girl next door to go behind the green door. And she did. And they said, yeah, I'm sorry. But that was the paradox of being Marilyn Chambers. This incredible stroke of luck catapulted her to fame. And she was known as a porn star, but when she auditioned for the role of a porn star, she was considered too wholesome to be one. So that was something that kind of followed her around in her career for the rest of her life.
I mean, she auditions for Behind the Green Door in the first place to try and become famous, because that was her ambition in life. She wanted to become famous, and she had legitimate talent. She could sing, dance, she acted. Then she achieves the fame, but it's not sort of the fame she wants. Yeah. And then it just kind of like docks her for the rest of her life. She can't sort of get out from behind the green door once she's there.
Yeah. No, she can't. Yeah. And in the '70s, it was sort of okay because it was new Hollywood. It was more violence, more sex. So it was a little more acceptable. But she wasn't taken seriously by critics when she did non-X-rated stuff. So when she did her cabaret act, and when she did her Broadway musical and would appear in David Cronenberg's film, she wasn't taken seriously as an actress because they thought, well, you're a porn star, so you can't act. Anyone in porn was not a true actor or actress, but that's not exactly true. She went to acting school. She had been in films before, pre-Behind the Green Door. So it's not that she couldn't act. She could, but she never got the right chance or the right script or the right director to really bring out that side of her. I really wanted readers to come away feeling frustrated, because that's how I felt, and that's I know how she felt, and I know she felt that because fortunately she gave hundreds, if not thousands, of interviews in her lifetime in print, in on television, films, radio, every medium. And she was a very honest and very open person. So she didn't really hold anything back in terms of how she was feeling. And maybe that turned some people off too, you know, but what most people didn't realize is that Marilyn Chambers is not her real name. That's a stage
Sure.
name. That was a character she created. And she played this character for a good decade. And in the sense, while she was doing so, kind of lost her sense of self, of who she really was. And by the time she was sort of sick of playing Marilyn Chambers, she had no idea who she was or who she wanted to be. But I think we all kind of go through that in our lives as humans. You know, we all might have a career where we had a job for a long time and then thought, I can't do this anymore. And we want to do something else, but we don't really know where to start. And she went through that. It's just, she went through that much later in life because in her 20s, she was playing Marilyn Chambers, this sex goddess.
You mentioned she was very open in her interviews, and she gave a lot of them. So I'm wondering, you obviously have a lot of material to work with when you're writing a biography, especially on a controversial subject. You're going to have decisions to make about what to include and what not to include. Were there any ethical dilemmas on like, oh, you know, I should put this in, but then her family's going to read this? You know, how did you navigate that challenge, especially as a first-time biographer?
Well, I think because her daughter and I became such good friends, you know, right off the bat, and we both respected each other, and she saw that I was really wanted to tell her mother's story in an honest way and respected her mother, I told her point blank, like, I'm going to put the ugly stuff in there too. So it might not be easy for you to read. So we did have conversations about that. She never once said, please don't put that in there, or please, you know, remove that. I did have people tell me stories off the record that I didn't put in. But for the most part, I didn't feel any ethical challenges because I tried to put it in her words. And because she gave so many interviews, whenever I sort of questioned what was she thinking or doing, fortunately, there was an interview that usually corresponded to, you know, that particular part of her life.
I want to talk to you real quickly about the actual writing of the book. I'm always curious when I chat with other authors about their writing process.
As far as writing, I usually had to go away to Palm Springs, which is
my. Oh, well, that's not bad.
And, you know, I rent this one home, and that's where I wrote like 90% of the book. You know, I would go for a week and try to get as much writing done as I can. So I kind of used that period as those were work trips, but I still had a full-time job on top of that. I would usually write during the day, unless I had like kind of a moment of inspiration at night. And I would definitely, you know, sometimes, you know, writer's block, sometimes I couldn't. So I would use those times to do research. A lot of it was putting like a jigsaw puzzle together because, okay, I know I have this quote here. Where did I get that? It's from this magazine. So where am I going to plug that in? And then moving stuff around. So that was how I approached the writing.
Did you edit as you go, or did you force yourself to just keep plowing forward and then going back to reread? I find if I stop to edit as I'm going, everything gets derailed.
Yeah, I have to keep, even if it doesn't make sense, even if it's a fragment, even if it's just like three words that I'm like, I'll come back to this later because I can't think of a sentence right now. I have to keep going to move the story along.
And for people who are listening who are contemplating their first biography, what would be your advice to first-time authors?
Just do it. If you have this idea and you really want to do something, just keep doing it and just trust that the universe is going to provide if you do the work and find a community and, you know, join an organization like Bio, because that is invaluable when you're doing it the first time out.
Great. Well, Jared, it's been fantastic talking to you, and I'll see you at Bio in June.
Yeah. Thanks, Simon.
That was first-time biographer Jared Stearns speaking with fellow biographer Simon Reed about his book, Pure, The Sexual Revolutions of Marilyn Chambers. It was published by Head Press in May 2024, and this interview was recorded via Zoom in January of this year. To learn more about Bio or to hear other episodes in our podcast series, please visit our website, biographersinternational.org. I'm BioMember Sonia Williams in Washington, D.C. Darren Neblett created our theme music. And until next time, thanks so much for listening and have a wonderful day.